This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bahnsen Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
All right, we're going to begin now the second period. I'd like to talk about the subject that is now, we always talk about the same thing for just a while, the enforcement of morals, subject to this coming to be the question that was coming in the title, the enforcement of morals. There are those who maintain what I call the liberty ideal. Perhaps the best classic exponent of the liberty ideal would be John Stuart Mill in his book on liberty. It is the opinion of Mill and those who, in one way or another, share his philosophy for political ethics, that the state ought not to enforce laws against any activity of man except such activities which infringe on the liberties of others, infringe upon the well-being and liberty of others. If you're doing harm to another person, then the state has the right to engage in coercive activities to punish your misdeed. But apart from that, the state has no business interfering whatsoever. And naturally, it's just a number of steps down the line to get to the rhetoric of victimless crime in terms of the liberty idea. We should try to maximize liberty as in society, meaning that anything that doesn't harm somebody else and deprive them of his liberty ought to be perfectly legitimate within our society. Now, in a textbook that I have used in the PEL, in political theory classes, reference to the philosophy of the state by PEL, the ABV-ATE, we have a discussion of the kinds of rights that the state might guard. As he discusses the ideal, I think it would be helpful just to look at the pages 142 to 146 here. Well, it says, the question of limits has proved to be a thorny one, limits on what the state should punish and what it should not punish. The problem is our apparent inability or unwillingness to draw a precise formula with one political liberty has exceeded the rightful bounds. John Stuart Mill, in his classic on liberty, proposed the following general formula. Now I'm quoting from Mill. The sole ends for which mankind are warranted individually or collectively, and interfering with the liberty of action of any of their number is self-protection. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. The only part of the conduit of any one for which he is amenable to society is that which concerns others. In the part which merely concerns himself, his independence is of right absolute. End of quote. Now, Abbott points out that the major difficulty with this test is the variability of the notion of harm. I don't want to go too quickly. I want to cover a lot of things here, and my tendency is to start galloping here and leave you behind. Okay. Mill says the only reason you punish somebody is because he's causing harm to somebody else. His own individual liberty is absolute. Okay, Abbott says, the major difficulty with this test is the variability of the notion of harm. We would be inclined to agree that physically harming someone is probably the clearest case. And we might reasonably want to extend the concept of harm to include damage to one's reputation, and so hold that laws against libel and slander are legitimate constraints on freedom, on free speech and press. Harm might also include the destruction of goods essential to human survival. Okay, so we give some examples of what we would probably call clear cases of harm. And then Abbott says, how much further, however, are we to extend the idea of harm? One, we might think it justifiable for the state to forbid the destruction of food during famine. But on what grounds does it outlaw polygamy or communal marriage? Two, should we forbid a religion to practice human sacrifice even when the victims are perfectly willing? Once you look at the facetious example, But first, you all know what a snuff film is. I don't want to get into the debaucheries of sadomasochism, but a snuff film allows the person, of course, to be beaten to death consensually. He consents to the fact that in terms of this beating, he may die. So it happens. Should the state outlaw not only substantive crimes like burglary and arson, but also inchoate crimes that is planning to commit a burglary or an arson? Should the state set limits on publications and films by reason of the pornographic works in nature? Should we forbid homosexuality among consenting rational parties? Should we allow governments to regulate advertising or to enforce an equal time provision on the electronic media? Should we give a public forum to people who espouse the view that certain racial groups are genetically inferior to others? He's going through seven examples, and he says, is there one sense of harm, quote-unquote, which proceeds intact throughout cases such as these? If there is, then it appears to be so wide as to license almost anything as harm. On what ground do we call them all harm? Fit them into the same genus? I think that I'm going to leave off my reading at Abbott at that point and simply point out that from a philosophical point of view, the liberty ideal that says we should not enforce morals, we can only enforce laws against doing harm to others, amounts to not saying anything at all, if it, in fact, can be logically forced to condone any kind of law. In the name of limiting law, it simply allows any kind of law to count as preventing harm to others. I give an example in my book on homosexuality and arguing against this point of view. My wife and I were both very aware when we left Southern California, moved to Philadelphia for my seminary training, that my wife's parents were quite saddened and, if you will, emotionally harmed by that, because they saw their daughter leaving the state for the first time and going away never for us to come back. And there was a great deal of emotional grief over that. And while we can now look back upon that as a charming attitude, at the time we were very conscious of how they were really not happy that we were leaving. Now, did the state have laws against us to intend if we were harming her parents emotionally? Now, everybody wants to say no, but now I want to ask you, on what principle do you find that harm as legitimate harm to some of the others from the examples that Alice gave as not being legitimate or as being legitimate? On what basis do you decide what is illegitimate harm? You see, as long as the notion is wide open, if somebody tells me, I'm going to reverse my strategy here, so I'm going to explain it another way. Let us imagine I'm taking a stand, as I do publicly, for civil laws against public homosexual practice. By public, we simply mean a crime that can be proven in a court of law. It doesn't have to be flaunted. It simply has to be so public as that it is provable. That through due process, you could convict a person of engaging in a homosexual act. I am convinced that the state very rightly has laws on its books against that provable homosexual practice. Okay, now, those who disagree with me, in fact, this is the whole discussion of the enforcement of morals is stimulated in our day by what has been labeled the Wolfenden Report in England, which had to do with the English attitude in civil law toward homosexuality. Okay, so we're right into the thick of it. We start talking about this issue of homosexual rights. Now, I argue that the homosexual does not have civil rights with respect to that practice, that it's a criminal activity. He does have rights, as any other criminal does. He has the right to a speedy trial, the right to a lawyer, the right to a fair trial, and that sort of thing. So we're not saying that you can just do whatever you want with homosexuals in a lynch mob attitude, but we are saying they do not have civil rights. They simply have criminal rights. Okay, now, if I argue this is a criminal deed, most likely my opponent is going to say, well, you then believe in the enforcement of morals. And I don't believe in the enforcement of morals. I believe we ought to only punish people when they harm others. Very likely, I'm going to try to reduce this man's position to absurdity in at least two ways. One, I'm going to say, you don't believe in the enforcement of morals. You only believe we ought to stop people from harming others. By what moral standard do you decide we shouldn't harm others?
You see, he says he doesn't believe in the enforcement of morals. What he really means is that he doesn't believe in the enforcement of my morals. He believes in the enforcement of his morals. Now, before you attempted to say, but you Christians would punish just anything. You would want to enforce private morality. As a matter of fact, my moral system, which is benefit is in me, I try to define by the word of God, but the moral system of the Bible certainly distinguishes between criminal behavior and sinful behavior. And we've gone over this a little bit in the past. All crimes happen to be sins also. But not all sins turn out to be crimes as well. Okay? Coveting something that is not mine is sinful. It is not a crime. There's no way it could be made a crime. The state could be enforced that even if it said it wanted to. Okay? But not only that, there are certain external deeds which are sins, which are not crimes. According to the Word of God, overeating or speaking rudely to somebody would be a sin, but it would not be a crime to overeat or speak rudely to somebody. Okay, so I do not believe that all sins are to be enforced with the civil sword. I believe that only those sins which are punishable by the civil magistrate are crimes. Only those which the Word of God says should be punished by the magistrate should be punished by the magistrate. So not all sins are punishable, and I don't believe there are in the enforcement of every moral standard. I believe in the enforcement of a moral system. Or, if you will, honoring the fact that within a certain moral system, there are things defined as criminal deeds. Now, if somebody says, well, in your interpretation, it's not right to enforce the Christian moral system in society. We could rather only punish people who bring harm to others. And the first thing I'm going to say is, why should we punish people who bring harm to others? How's he going to answer that without reverting to some moral system? Now, the fact that he can only defend the opinion by reverting to some moral system indicates that he do believe in the enforcement of a moral system. He may not believe in the enforcement of every moral standard, even if I don't believe in the enforcement of every moral standard, but he has his own philosophy of morals that leads him to say, this is criminal and the other is not criminal. So I also have a moral system that distinguishes between sin and crime. And what I want to know is why it is wrong for me to urge the state to enforce my system of morality, but it's right for him to urge the state to enforce his. You see, what he's reducing is a self-contradiction, or if you will, arbitrary spiritual pleading. What's soft for the goose doesn't turn out to be soft for the gander. Mainly because I guess he's used the honorific language of, I don't believe in the enforcement of morals. But you know, that's one route we can take. Another route we can take is this. I can say, I don't believe that the state should punish anything but doing that which is harmful to others. And as a matter of fact, everything that God says the state should punish is in one way or another punishable to others. That's what you call standing your opponent's position. You take what he says is his principle, and you go ahead and show that his principle can work in your favor. You see, if his principle is so wide that harm means anything and everything, then I certainly can say that homosexual deeds, even though they may be between two standing adults, is harmful to me. The two that are involved in harmful to society at large. Because we know in what way is it harmful? Well, it may be there is such a thing as indirect harm, destroying the moral fiber of society. If also Paul certainly thought that public homosexuality was harmful to the Roman Empire, he said the wrath of God was revealed from heaven against the Roman Empire for that very reason. We certainly know that public homosexuality was harmful to the Sodom. God reduced the city of the flame to ash because of it. And so the Christians can say, I just happen to think we ought to avoid the historical judgment of God. No, what we ought to punish homosexuals. Likely, that's not going to be any more pleasing an answer to your atheist opponents or to your secular opponents than the first one. But the point is, as long as he states his position in terms of harm, we can answer in terms of harm. And so he defines what harm is, so that it rules in only the cases of crimes that he wants and rules it off the cases of crime that we want that he doesn't, then he isn't really giving us an argument. He's simply, if you will, substituting one verbal formula for what is his position in the first place. He's restating himself under a different linguistic rubric.
I'm going to do something that I know better than to do. I'm not even going to bother to look at my notes. That seems like a good place to stop. And if I won't look at my notes, I won't think you're going to be there for God. I'm sure that you will. Let me open it up to questions. We'll take questions for a while, and then what I'll do is go on to our next topic, and that's welfare. Again, as time allows, we'll talk about that for a little while. Questions about the enforcement of morals.
What would the Volstead Act have fallen under 40C?
Why don't you explain to everybody what the Volstead Act is?
Prohibition.
So explain exactly what prohibition was.
Well, to the planet standard, prohibition, and Volstead Act prohibited the manufacturing and importation and sale of alcoholic beverages in the United States.
Obviously, that's not new. Is there anything obvious about anything? No. Let's say that this is the Volstead Act prohibits selling of alcoholic beverages. Okay? It didn't prohibit the selling of wine decisions, by the way. But, whatever. Would that be just, well, I mean, because then we didn't have the word supper, right? I don't get the impression that we have everybody going through. We're going to have to talk, Charles. Okay, the state says that it will now be illegal to sell alcoholic goods and to traffic in alcoholic goods. That is in suit of some moral standard. I mean, there's some system of morality that leads to that conclusion. This is the biblical system of morality. It's the first question I want to ask, I think, of that. Is it that the Bible prohibits the selling of alcoholic beverages, the trafficking in it? Well, it's a very touchy subject, as this ethics class, you know, revealed, excuse me, the alcoholic beverages and Christian movement and that sort of thing. Really, there are some Christians who believe the Bible prohibits the use of any alcoholic beverage. And the very reason I mention the fact that communion wine is to be used to does seem to cause some problems for that attitude. Jesus instituted the use of alcoholic beverages. It's one of the most holy sacraments in the church. But well, that wasn't very much. There isn't a whole lot of one. The first question is, does the Bible in fact prohibit alcoholic beverages? And I'm going to work on the assumption now, counterfactually, that the Bible does. It is my sincere heart filled conviction that the Bible prohibits drunkenness, and I prohibit and preach against drunkenness with all my heart. And I do not believe the Bible prohibits alcoholic beverages, and that's true. As was pointed out by our beloved Dr. Cipitola of the Old Testament Department, that the Old Testament requires the use of alcoholic beverages when a person is of sad countenance and all the rest of you, to give him drink so that he will forget his problems. Notice how we, I just let Dr. Cipitola take care of that problem. I will assume, counterfactually, that the Bible prohibits drinking alcoholic beverages. The question is, does the Bible say that the state should prohibit the alcoholic beverages? Let's take an analogy from homosexual practice. The Bible prohibits homosexual emotion, okay? Romans 1 speaks very clearly that the burning of homosexual lust is evil and degrading and condemned by God. However, the Bible also condemns homosexual acts. And so that alone makes it right for the church to say that a person must repent
of homosexual deeds, if he's willing to make a credible profession of faith, when the church come to the Lord's table and all the rest. And while he may struggle with that sin, even if I struggle with the sin of overeating or something, nevertheless, Joshua has made a break with it and making an effort to have, you know, victory over that sin. Now, it turns out that the Bible goes beyond that. It goes beyond condemning homosexual desire and homosexual activity. It also says that the state should punish homosexual activity. So that in Leviticus 18, if a man lies with a man, the woman then, it is a matter of blood guiltiness, and they are put to death. So in this case, the Bible condemns the liar, the act, and ultimately the criminal offense. If I were to say that the Bible condemns the drinking of alcoholic beverages, it would not be sufficient to say the desire for alcohol or the drinking of alcohol is morally wrong, that it's a sin, if you will, but I would also show biblical grounds for the civil magistrate having to punish it. Now, short of being the Bible allows the magistrate to punish with alcoholic beverages, then it would turn out that the law set out was really the improper enforcement of morals. It was making a sin into a crime. In a sense, I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because the position I take on homosexuality is more and more unpopular these days, and it's often thought to people who believe in punishing homosexuals that they believe in enforcing Christian moral standards across the board. And as a matter of fact, I would have argued very strongly on principled grounds against prohibition, what it calls prohibition. Another question on enforcement of morals?
Sir. I know this quote of the Old Testament is adequate authority against the homosexuality. Do you have anything like that from the New Testament?
Yes, I have a blanket endorsement of everything that's in the Old Testament from Jesus, where he says, any man who breaks the least of these commandments and teaches them so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And as I see it, that is presumptive authority in the New Testament for any moral standards in the Old Testament, except those of Jesus himself or the apostles will make amendments with respect to it. What I'm saying is that the burden of proof shifts back to the person who defends homosexual practice to show that the New Testament takes a different attitude toward the Old Testament view of homosexuality. But in addition to that, we do have confirmatory evidence. It's important to point out methodologically the burden of proof is on that person who wants to go against the Old Testament rather than on the person who is following it. The burden of proof, according to Jesus' words, lies on anybody who dares contradict any Old Testament commandment. But now, in the case of homosexuality, I can also give you explicit New Testament confirmation, and I would find that, first of all, in Romans 1, where Paul condemns homosexual activity as sinful, and he goes on to say at the end of the chapter, so those who commit such deeds know the ordinance of God, the law of God, that such deeds are worthy of death. Moreover, you'll find in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 8 to 10, what Paul writes to Timothy is that the law of God is lawfully used when it is used to restrain those who are unruly in society. And he says the law has been given for, and he says, murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers and those who commit fornication and homosexual. And as a matter of fact, Paul goes so far as to use both the Greek words for homosexuality there, those who take the active as well as the passive role in the homosexual relationship. And so Paul is very explicit, almost in an ugly way explicit, as to what he's saying. And he says the law was given to restrain this sort of thing. And so I think we do have New Testament evidence that the law of God with respect to homosexuality is still binding.
You've answered my question.
Other questions? Okay, let's talk about welfare. The whole idea of benefit rights. Let's proceed on the assumption that a person has a right to a minimal income. Okay, I'm going to take one of the more obvious cases. A person has a right to a minimal income. Okay, he has a right to a certain, if you will, level of monetary assistance.
Now, what do we mean when we say that a person has a right?
Now, we've already pointed out in the past there are different kinds of rights, but what is common to all the kinds of rights?
What does a right mean? To be in possession of a right means that you are licensed in the use, enjoyment, or expectation of that which is your right. And it means that others have an obligation to perform those actions which the right involves and or to refrain from those actions which would prevent the exercise of the right. Let me say that again. A right to something means that you are licensed in the use, enjoyment, and expectation of that something, and that there are obligations on the part of others to perform those actions which the right involves and or refrain from those actions which would prevent the exercise of that right. So every time there's a right, it turns out there's a corresponding duty on the part of others. If somebody has a right, somebody else has a duty. And it simply does not make sense to speak of somebody having a right unless somebody else has the corresponding duty. The duty to perform actions which the right involves or refrain from actions which prevent the exercise of the right. Now, freedom rights entail the corresponding duty of forbearance. If I have a freedom right, in the case of free speech, then somebody else has the corresponding duty of forbearing me to speak. Because that's what free speech means. The right to free speech means somebody has the duty, as it turns out the rest of the society has the duty, to forbear.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.